Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is Joshua Armstrong Appellant versus the State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Christopher Miles, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Ms. Erin Hanke, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Miles, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christopher Miles. I'm here representing Joshua Armstrong. In this case, there really aren't any facts that are in dispute. Mr. Armstrong was serving time in the penitentiary. He was incarcerated on a previous sex offense conviction. While he was in the penitentiary, Mr. Armstrong sent a packet of letters. Those letters were addressed to PREA, which is an acronym for the Prison Rape Elimination Act. The reason Mr. Armstrong sent those letters and addressed them to PREA was to make sure that they would get out of the penitentiary. The letters were sent to the Compass Center. They were received by Michelle Margraf, an employee at the Compass Center. She received these letters, she read them, and she became concerned with the content that was in these letters. She contacted a DCI agent. The DCI agent then did contact penitentiary. Ultimately, what was in these letters was then relayed to CH, who was the object of the threatening nature and a mental health counselor at the penitentiary. Because no facts are in dispute, really at the heart of this appeal are issues of statutory interpretation. The statute that Mr. Armstrong was convicted of at trial is South Dakota Code Law 22-22-45, which reads, any person who has been convicted of a felony sex offense who directly threatens or communicates specific intent to commit further felony sex offenses is guilty of threatening to commit a sexual offense. Now, there are three issues that are before the court that were briefed. The first issue was whether or not the trial court erred in denying Armstrong's motion for judgment of acquittal. That would be reviewed under a de novo standard. And the question before the court is, was there evidence in the record sufficient to sustain a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? And within that question, there are two questions that our brief does ask this court to answer. And the first would be, what is the meaning of the term directly within this statute? And does that term modify both the word threatens and the word communicates within that statute? Now, our argument is that the evidence is insufficient because these letters were not sent directly to CH, the object of the threat. These letters were addressed to PREA, then sent to the Compass Center. And in that regard, they were not direct. We would ask the court to look at language from a 2002 case, People X Rel CCH. And in that case, there was a student who told the teacher that he wanted to kill a couple of his classmates. And on appeal, this court stated, clearly the evidence proves that the threats were not communicated directly to the intended victims. Similar to that case, here we have threatening communications which moved along intermediaries. There were people in the middle. Ultimately, they did get back to CH.
Let me stop you there for a minute. So the CCH case, that dealt with the court addressing a First Amendment defense, correct?
That's correct. That was analyzed under true threat doctrine. We are not asking the court to review whether this is a First Amendment free speech issue. We believe that the language that was just referenced does indicate that directly, as it is stated in this statute, does refer to the manner of the communication. At the trial court level, the state really did argue that there's not much of a difference between a direct or a specific threat, and we would urge that that is not the case. Direct really does have to do with the manner in which the communication is transported.
So do you think, so your argument contemplates that not only that direct modifies, threatens, and communicates, but are you also suggesting that it's an ambiguous term that we have to determine using rules of statutory construction?
We would ask the court to define within the context of this statute what directly does mean. And the primary issue was because at the trial court level, the state did argue that there really was not a difference between a direct threat or a specific threat. And we believe that those terms were conflated at the trial court level.
So as I understand your argument, you're suggesting that there's really two issues. What does directly mean, first of all, and whether it also applies to the second clause of the statute, the communicate a specific intent. But first, with regard to the directly portion, where in the statute, because you seem to be arguing that it had to be made directly to the object of the intended threat. And in this case, that's the individual CH that the threat was about. So where in the statutory language do you find that requirement?
Simply looking at the term direct as it is in the statute, and because indirect is not in the statute. In our brief, we also addressed the State versus Paulson case, which was a 2015 case. In that case, there was a pro se litigant who was filing many motions to the court. Some of them did contain language that was threatening in nature. That individual ended up being prosecuted under South Dakota Codified Law 22-11-15, which, I am paraphrasing, states that any person who directly or indirectly threatens a judicial officer. So our argument would be that it would require direct simply because it is in the statute and because indirect was not included.
But that's also an example of a statute which had explicit language indicating that the threat had to go to a specific person, to a judicial officer. Correct?
Correct. That statute did contemplate the object of the threat.
And we don't have that type of language in the statute that we are looking at here, do we?
We do not have that type of language. We would argue that that is still important. The state's argument on appeal is that the or serves as a disjunctive because threatens or communicates is how it is written in the statute, that directly only applies to the threatening language. However, we think that looking at this statute, if we were to really take threatens, directly threatens, and separate it from communicates specific intent, really Armstrong could have cellmate, I intend on committing another rape. He could have etched it into the wall of his cell, and he would be within the purview of this statute simply because he expressed or communicated a specific intent to commit a further felony sex offense. And we would believe that that is an absurd result, and the idea behind this statute was to ensure that the people that are the object of the threat are not receiving them directly.
So you gave one hypothetical. Let me give you another one. Under your suggestion that directly threatens, the direct also has to refer to communicate. So presumably I take you to mean that every threat has to go straight to the object of the threat in order for it to qualify under this statute. Is that your argument?
Yes, Justice. That.
So then what if we have the hypothetical where we have the registered sex offender, as in the case here, that sends a letter to a parent of a child and has in that letter a threat saying, I intend to rape your child. Under your interpretation, would that type of a scenario not fall within the purview of the statute?
Under a strict reading, it would not. believe that hypothetical is so difficult to answer with a parent being the recipient and a minor child being the object of the threat. But a strict reading of the statute, we would argue that that is not a direct threat.
And we have additional language in the statute also, don't we? It's not just the threatens or communicates, it's directly threatens, and then we have communicates a specific intent to commit a further felony sex offense. There's two meanings when you look at that entire second clause, not just the word communicate.
It's odd in the sense that threatens and communicates a specific intent really are a distinction without a difference. What is a threat? A threat is a communication of intent to do a certain thing. Communication of intent to do a certain thing, usually unlawful, is a threat. Looking at this statute, it's unclear if possibly the legislature intended to. The word threat also is a term of art. There's defenses that people could assert, maybe trying to ensnare more conduct, more language, as opposed to more communications and how they are either directly or indirectly transported to the person. Now, with regard to whether or not directly does modify both, jury instruction number 17 in this case, which contained the elements of the offense, which stated that Mr. Armstrong would need to be found guilty of one specific element being communicating a direct threat or communication. Those were contained within one element of the jury instructions. So I guess there would also be a question as to whether the jury unanimously believed that he directly threatened CH or if he communicated specific intent to commit a further felony sex offense with reference to CH. One example that we would use, use a simple example to demonstrate, take an art museum, and the art museum has a rule. Any person that purposefully touches or contacts the artwork will be removed from the museum. A plain reading of that statute would lead a reasonable person to believe that it is purposeful touching and purposeful contact which is subject to punishment. And we believe that is also the case here. Direct threatening and direct communications are what are the subject of punishment. We also have the stalking statute, which is SDCL 22-19A-1-1, which states that no person may willfully, maliciously, or repeatedly follow or harass another person. Again, a plain reading of that would lead a person to believe that willful, malicious, and repeated following and willful, malicious, and repeated harassment are what the statute is looking to punish.
Mr. Miles, on the subject of the jury instructions, which instruction did you say was, or maybe you didn't, but did you say one of the instructions, or perhaps more than one, is incorrect in your view?
That would be jury instruction, I believe, number 17.
Which just lists the elements of the offense.
Correct. And when looking at that jury instruction, our argument is that because both the language directly threaten or communicate are within one element, that it would not be a disjunctive either or situation.
Did you propose a jury instruction that would separate them or in some way be superior to the one the court gave?
Trial counsel did not propose an instruction to separate those two different clauses.
Is this even the case that we can reach this issue on then? Because if that objection doesn't exist, and we have instructions that say what the statute says, and we have a general verdict that says guilty, how are we to know that the jury based its decision to convict your client on the error you assert exists now on appeal?
And we do recognize that that was not asserted in the briefs. It was something that came to light here recently. Possibly be asking the court to review that for plain error. All in all, we think that what that does is supports our argument that direct does, in fact, modify both threatens and communicates.
So is this a general or a specific intent crime?
Justice, that was the third issue that was briefed before the court. Armstrong is arguing that this is a specific intent crime. At the trial court level, counsel did propose an instruction which indicated that the state must prove that Mr. Armstrong acted with the specific design or purpose to threaten CH. Now, again, this statute was enacted in 2006. I'm not sure if there has been any other prosecutions under this statute. I'm not familiar with any appellate cases which have dealt with this. But within that statute is the term specific intent. And that is a legal term of art. And it would be our position that because the legislature used the word specific intent in that statute, that they did intend for it to be a specific intent crime.
But the way it's used in this particular statute communicates a specific intent to commit a further felony sex offense. Isn't the use of it there getting at the nature of the communication rather than whether or not the person sending it actually had the specific intent to carry out the threat? Would you agree with that?
I would agree. The statute is framed in a way that it's not necessary. Many specific intent statutes ask, did the person do the act with the unlawful purpose in mind, as opposed to, did the person do the act?
Well, I think specific intent is to have an intent that goes beyond an intention to commit the act itself. Correct?
Correct. This is a difficult issue. Ultimately, I think it does reach back to whether or not, looking at the facts of this case, Mr. Armstrong did testify in the case, and he did indicate that, the entire reason that he was sending these letters out was so that he could get his day in court and try to air grievances about his prior conviction. When he found out, this is his testimony, when he found out that CH did become aware of the letters and that she was the object of the threats in those letters, he said that he apologized to her. I think ultimately what it gets at is whether or not a person can convey specific intent, communicate specific intent, without having the actual specific intent can be a circular argument there. And I will concede that this is a difficult issue to try and hash out exactly what was intended. However,
it appeared from the underlying record that you submitted the case of Alanis versus United States to the trial court for consideration of the
minutes.
Intent? Did you?
I did not handle this case at the trial court level. But the attorney, in arguing for a specific intent instruction, that was discussed. I would also note that in a pretrial motions hearing, the state argued that this was a specific intent crime, and the court also agreed, and because of that, there were certain portions of the letters which were deemed admissible and submitted to the jury under the rationale that this was a specific intent crime. However, at the trial, when this was proposed, the court reversed course, flip-flopped, and decided that this was a general intent crime. So in that sense, there was error in the fact that Mr. Armstrong was cut by both sides of the double-edged sword.
The instruction actually given by the court, though, had some of the same aspects that the one that was proposed by the defense, didn't it? And it actually almost tracked the same, the Alanis, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, which was addressing mens rea on a very similar statute, didn't it?
There were two jury instructions that dealt with the intent. One was a very broad general intent pattern jury instruction, and the other, I believe that the court is referencing, it did indicate that in order to find Mr. Armstrong guilty, they would need to find that he acted with the intent to threaten. Different than that is in the proposed jury instruction is that we were asking that the court recognize that he must have the intent to threaten CH. He must have been acting with the specific design or purpose to threaten CH. And again, it's odd because Mr. Armstrong, he did have the intent to get charged with a crime. He wanted to be before a court so that he could and speak about what he had, what his gripes were with his prior conviction.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. Ms. Hanke, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here today to ask this court to affirm defendant's conviction. The trial court properly denied defendant's motion for judgment of acquittal and properly denied defendant's two proposed jury instructions. In 2016, defendant was an inmate in the state penitentiary here in South Dakota for a prior sex conviction. It was a sexual contact with a person under 16. At that same time, CH was a counselor at the prison who provided counseling services to defendant's unit. In August, defendant wrote two letters and sent them with some other materials to the Compass Center and did label them PREA, which is Prison Rape Elimination Act. He did this so prison staff would not intercept these letters and they would get out. In the first letter, it was a 3-page letter addressed to whom it may concern. The second letter, an 18-page letter addressed to then Governor Dugard. And in these letters, the defendant wrote in excruciatingly graphic detail, raping and killing his counselor, CH. Defendant stated, "I am absolutely serious about what I said about CH. I have got nothing to lose and everything to gain by raping and killing her or a guard. I would gladly stand in front of a jury for sexual assault and most likely murder and tell them someone like CH had to be raped and murdered." When the center received these letters, they were obviously concerned. They contacted law enforcement and DCI was sent in to investigate. During his interview with DCI, defendant, when asked about the letters, defendant stated, "If I have to do something stupid like that, I will." Defendant was charged and subsequently convicted at trial under SDCL 22-2245. In viewing the evidence in light most favorable to the state, there was sufficient evidence to support defendant's conviction. I know defense counsel spent a lot of time arguing that this statute, what does this statute mean? This statute reads in part, person who directly threatens or communicates specific intent to commit further felony sex acts. They are separated by the word or. Or is usually used in the disjunctive, meaning a choice between two mutually exclusive things. You either directly threaten or communicate specific intent. It's an either or situation. And we have that, the state proved that. The state had to prove defendant had a prior felony sex conviction. That was stipulated to, no questions about it. The state had to prove defendant directly threatened or communicated specific intent to commit a further felony sex act. He admitted to writing these letters. He did not deny writing these letters. He admitted to DCI. He admitted to the jury at trial. He talked about how serious he was. He's absolutely serious about what I said about CH. He said he was serious. And he also went into detail about how he would seek this mental health treatment to get CH alone, and then in extremely graphic detail depicted what he would do to this poor woman once he got her alone.
Just for clarification, is it the state's position that it is the or communicates a specific intent to commit a sexual offense portion that the conduct here falls within, or could it be either?
I think, Your Honor, it could be either in this situation. He directly threatened. He took the time out to send this letter to a person and wrote his threat in the he wrote his threat to a person. That is the direct communication.
So your interpretation of directly under that scenario is that it doesn't mean it has to go to the object of the threat.
That is correct. Nowhere in the statute does it say that the defendant must directly threaten his intended victim.
Okay, go ahead.
So in finishing your first question, Justice, or the communicate specific intent is obviously clear in the graphic detail of his letter. So the state's position is he violated under both clauses, if you will.
And so I think the argument on the other side, however, is that we may have some statutes where the adverb modifier, a reading of it suggests that it may apply to more than the first term that are separated by ors. So how do we reconcile your suggested interpretation with some of those other statutes?
Well, for starters, in defendant's brief, they use the example of controlled drug or substance, and that has actually been defined by the legislature as a term of art. Controlled drug or substance is defined statutorily, where controlled applies to both drug and substance, even though they are separated by the word or. And I know today he's the harassment statute. I don't have the language in front of me, I apologize, but it was menacingly following or harassing. And in that situation, I don't know that you necessarily need to apply menacing to the harassment. That is what harassment is. And further evidence is how these are two separate clauses and they do have different meanings is because they just have to have different meanings. If we read this as a person has to directly threaten or directly communicate, that's redundant language. We then have surplus in our statute. This court has defined threaten in State v. Paulson, a case defense counsel cited. It's 2015 SD-12, as threatens is a communicated intent to inflict harm. So if we read this statute as a defendant is asking, would say in part, any person who directly communicates intent to inflict harm or directly communicates specific intent to commit further felony sex offenses. It's the same thing. They have to have different meanings. The statute says directly threatens or communicates specific intent to commit these acts. Ending into defendant's unanimity issue, that issue was never raised at the trial court. It was never raised in his brief, and the state would argue that that issue is waived. I don't think there's a unanimity issue. The state presented this to the trial court as a one act.
Issue?
I'm sorry, what's that?
Ambiguity issue?
The unanimity issue,
unanimity,
Your Honor.
I'm sorry, forgive me. I was going to say, I asked the ambiguity question.
No. The state presented this as one act. This is just one act. And it wrote these letters, sent this packet. It was a one-time deal. And I don't think unanimity is an issue. Going off of Justice Salter, I do believe the statute is unambiguous. It is clear what the statute says. And I think that is supported by what I just said. If it's read as defendant proposes, it's redundant. And we don't read statutes to have surplus language.
You probably have to read more into the statute maybe this isn't right, but if the statute were construed to mean directly communicate, then it would just beg the question of to whom?
Correct, Your Honor.
So, right, then we'd have to, in your view, further construe the object of the direct communication?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The defense is asking not only to add directly and communicates, but they're also asking to add language to specify who this threat needs to be made to. The statute doesn't say who the threat needs to be made to. It is silent on that.
Would a person violate this statute if they communicated a specific threat to commit a felony sex offense by writing something indiscriminately on a wall or something that was just posted somewhere?
Absolutely. He's communicating that specific intent. He's communicating that intent. The statute doesn't specify how he has to communicate.
As long as the specific intent element.
Correct. It's not some off-the-cuff remark. It needs to be specific. And the statute does not say how it needs to be communicated, nor does it say to whom.
Moving to the question of the jury instruction issue. At trial, did the state propose specific or general intent instructions?
So at When it came time to settling jury instructions, the state proposed a general intent instruction. There was some talk at a prior motion hearing where the state originally did concede that it was a specific intent crime, but upon further research, the state changed its mind, presented an argument to the court about this is a general intent crime, and the court agreed with the state. And the trial court was correct. This is a general intent crime. And I get it, the statute says specific intent, but the specific intent does not go to defendant's mens rea in threatening or communicating. Specific intent here is the object of his communication. The crime is that or the communication, and the specific intent is what he is communicating. It does not give him an additional mens rea element that the state needed to meet.
That may be the case, but you know, the term specific intent has some real meaning in our law. The court didn't attempt to define that for the jury, whether this is a general intent crime or not. There had to be a communication or a threat of a specific intent to commit sex offense. The court didn't give that definition of what specific intent is, but that's really a part of the element of the offense, isn't it?
Yes, it is an element of the offense.
So do you think it should have been instructed on what specific intent is?
I don't think it was necessary here. Neither party obviously had requested they be defined specific intent. This defense asked that this be marked as a specific intent crime, but they'd never asked that the jury provided that additional information. And I don't think it was necessary. I think it was the instruction provided was sufficient for the jury to reach their verdict. So kind of looping back, state believes that the trial court was proper in denying its motion for judgment of acquittal and also proper in denying both of defendant's proposed instructions. If there's no additional questions, I ask this court to affirm defendant's conviction.
Nobody is ever chastised for quitting early.
Thank you.
Mr. Miles, you have 10 minutes rebuttal, sir.
Getting back into the term direct here, it is not defined. However, we believe that looking at just common usage would also lend itself to our argument. If a person requests direct payment, if a person is supposed to pay X, they don't say, I've paid Y, X can go and get it from Y. Direct really is about from one person to another without an intermediary.
So is your argument that the conviction's unsustainable under either purported theory of criminal liability, either as a direct threat or as a communication, direct or otherwise? Are you saying, look, the conviction couldn't work either way, or that there's a bigger problem with one theory of criminal liability than the other?
I suppose to a degree both. With what we would contend is the proper reading of the statute, Armstrong's actions could not be construed to be within the purview of this statute because, again, our interpretation is that direct does modify both threatens and communicates.
Counsel, could you respond to the state's argument that if we adopt your interpretation of direct, meaning it can't go through an intermediary, And you want us to read that term also in front of communicate in the statute. And if we do that, directly threaten or directly communicate a specific intent to commit a sex offense, how are those two phrases then not redundant?
They are redundant. And as I argued in the first round here, I believe that what really, at least our contention is that the legislature was looking at this thing, well, maybe somebody would say that was not a threat. It is more all-encompassing to say also we would require that a person be be found guilty or convicted of this statute if they have simply communicated a specific intent to say, well, that was not a threat, however, it was still a communication of specific intent, would not change whether or not it was direct. And we believe that is the most meaningful portion. It is a distinction without a difference in that sense. However, we believe that the reason behind that is not what the state purports that to be. Now, with regard to issue number three, there was a prejudicial effect due to the specific intent instruction not being given to the jury, and that would be because at trial, when the state was arguing in closing, they were arguing that even an indirect threat would be allowed, and that allowed the jury to convict. It allowed them to convict by lowering the burden here, not only on whether or not it was an indirect threat, but also whether or not Armstrong actually had that specific design. And we believe that that would have prejudiced Mr. Armstrong, at least in his ability to defend against this statute. With regard to issue number two, the instruction which was proposed, whether or not Armstrong could be found guilty unless he directly threatened or directly communicated. We understand that the state is essentially contending that we are asking to add language. However, looking at what occurred here, certainly a jury is not going to be highly inclined to acquit Mr. Armstrong due to, again, the graphic nature of what he was saying, some of the language that was used in these letters. However, trial counsel did, I believe, recognize that what at least the state was intending on arguing was that so many different things could fall within the purview of this statute that it was necessary to instruct the jury about what the meaning of direct and how it should be applied in this statute. We believe that that instruction was warranted by the evidence. We believe that that is a full and correct statement of law. Ultimately, we are not asking the court to consider what Mr. Armstrong did okay. We are essentially asking the court to give meaning to this statute and determine whether or not what Mr. Armstrong did fell within its punishment. The statute could certainly be rewritten, and the legislature may intend on doing that after this. However, at its current position, it is difficult to interpret, and we believe that the only correct interpretation is to have direct modifying both threatens and communicates. Without anything further,
thank you, Mr. Miles. Appreciate it.